I think it's important to read the texts as texts and to understand the words before you try to elaborate the theological implications. One of the problems of getting the theology before you get the texts sorted out is it may be very good theology, but it may not come from that text at all. And there have been more good sermons preached on the text that they didn't come from than you can imagine. So that one of my concerns is basically to open up these texts as poetic. To deliver us from reading them either as the former prophets, 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings, which have their long narrative sections, or read them as Job, which has a fairly continued narrative, or what I think is even more common, I think almost all of us in the West, since Augustine, read scripture as systematic thinking rather than poetic thinking, rather than letters. Paul sentences are impossible. You know, they're not a neat, well-organized progression of thought like the Enchiridion of Augustine. They're this problem and that problem, and it sounds a lot more like a board meeting than it does a theology class, you know. And it's a sort of a mixture of those blessed theological insights that overtake you in midstream, and practical advice and this sort of thing. And the prophets are. Take Isaiah. What we have here is a collection, an anthology of a number of short poetic sermons, a few narrative, sort of some autobiographical and some biographical, that are all pieced together into, or edited together into the Isaiah collection or the Isaiah anthology. And so there's real justification in taking them one by one and fitting them into some kind of sense of the development of the history of Israel and the development of Isaiah's thought. Much of Isaiah's early preaching is consciousness-raising for people who basically are, or a country which is basically innocent about its own vulnerability. Let's say that again. Most of the oracles would be judgment oracles, would be oracles which have as their point, the edge, the attempt to reorient Judah's consciousness to their actual historical circumstances, their limited situation, their vulnerability, not simply to Syria and to Judah, I mean, not simply to Syria and Samaria, but also to Assyria. The oracles are also addressed at, because there are judgment oracles on both Samaria and Assyria, the oracles are also addressed to delivering Judah from the kind of crisis anxieties which lead them to make precipitous judgment and compromise the integrity of their country and so on. And yesterday there we dealt with one in 9:8 through 10:4, in which there were five stanzas, and which four stanzas really are about Samaria and the destruction of Samaria, and the fifth then generalizes this to saying, well, this can happen to you too. This can happen to Judah too. It's something like talking about the decline in the British economy and the problems of the post-colonial era in Britain, and then turning around and saying, well, this can happen to America too. I mean, just because you have hit a certain peak doesn't mean you're going to stay there forever. And because you have hit a certain situation through a number of favorable circumstances doesn't mean that you can maintain that position simply by your own intentions or your own ingenuity. Then yesterday we hit one of our first messianic passages in 9, and we see it's a little bit like seeing the weather beyond the weather. In other words, you can see an immediate storm coming up, but you can still see the top of the mountain. And the messianic passages are, if much of Isaiah's preoccupation in this period is with wake up, come to yourself, get your head screwed on right, then there are times, and I'm not sure whether these are later poems put here by editors because they couldn't take the steady bleakness of the different sections of Isaiah, or whether they are occasional happy days that Isaiah had when he felt detached enough to look at the long haul and to reflect on Yahweh's faithfulness to rebuild after destruction. So that we had in 9:1, we had a good Messiah oracle about the new David who would have the government on his shoulders, and it would be would establish the kingdom, justice and righteousness would be established. All right, I want to get into plod through a couple more today, and hopefully get through to 11, and then we can talk a little bit more about what I would call the Messiah strategy of Yahweh. Don't be surprised. I think the simplest way. I keep thinking of J.B. Phillips. Your God is too small. Well, I would like to put it. Now, one of the big things about Yahweh that the prophets knew was that Yahweh was consistent and faithful. Therefore, when things really went wrong, there was an element of human accountability in it. There's an element of human accountability. Israel was responsible for some of the components in the destruction that they were to experience, and they could repent. They could change their direction. So there was an element of accountability. Nevertheless, Yahweh was free, and Yahweh was also full of surprises. And so I'd like to argue that the implication of that is, don't underestimate Yahweh. Don't expect him only in one place. And in fact, some days Isaiah said one thing on behalf of Yahweh, and some days he said something else. So that there is a this. It seems to me that we have to think in terms of Yahweh's capacity. All right, Yahweh's multiple strategies. The multiple strategies of Yahweh, so that there was one strategy for a certain kind of need, and when that was ineffective, there was another strategy. And when another day came, there was another strategy. So Yahweh is not a simple-minded politician. He's a real politician, really wrestling with the complexities and ambiguities and the stubbornness of his folk, and really about establishing a new order, a new human new human phase. And it's the sense of the continuity of Yahweh's intentions and the consistency of Yahweh's covenant love that you find the continuity, not in the specific content of the particular message, because the message today may be destruction and tomorrow may be reformation or rebuild. So that you've got to understand in a way how the prophets understood themselves to be representing a God who was alive, not an idea, and a God who interacted with human circumstances, not simply, pull the strings on human circumstances. So that when the people say no, in these oracles there are several of them where there's a wonderful step up. There's a message, the people don't respond to the message comes out much more radically and sharply, and then finally, the destruction and radical strategy is unveiled. So you have this sort of, Yahweh has a real personality and he interacts with human affairs. Okay. One of the liberal things about Isaiah's theology is he thinks God uses people that don't even know they're being used. So that he has no difficulty in seeing Assyria as the second Isaiah even calls Syria, Neo-Babylonia, the Messiah. But first Isaiah was content to see him as an instrument of Yahweh. So that none of this, only God only uses the people that believe wholly in him. There are some real blessings to being part of the covenant people and to being intimate with God, but being available for God's power clearly in the prophetic perspective clearly encompasses the whole nations. But then there's a point at which Yahweh decides to come to terms with Assyria. Assyria has been helpful to Yahweh because Assyria has knocked out the coalition between Syria and Samaria, which was threatening Judah. And Assyria came along and, knocked that out. And then Assyria comes up and wants to capture Jerusalem. Kind of ironic. But there's a point at which Yahweh comes to turn, has some oracles against Assyria, because the king of Assyria isn't any better off in some respects consciously than the other country. He still thinks that all of his accomplishments are contingent on his own military power and organization. So that in both cases you find Isaiah's preoccupation is with the conditionedness of human experience, the way in which human experience and human resources, human power, national power, are contingent on circumstances and resources and ultimate meanings, not simply contingent on the hard work, the ingenuity, the achievements of the people that are doing them or leading them. So that it's this the edge of Isaiah's thinking is directed at the inability to discriminate between one's contribution as leader and steward and the way in which that is contingent on the folk, the natural resources, the political needs, and is not simply a matter of a kind of success hero orientation. So that it's a very drastic attack on the special position theory, either the hero theory in terms of the individual, or the notion that the presence and status of covenant makes us inviolable, and so on. Well, let's really the text say this more clearly. 10:5. Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff of my fury. Against the godless nation I send him, against the people of my wrath I command him to take spoil and seize plunder. You know, that's really interesting, the drama of Isaiah's theology. Now, it's quite clear that Isaiah didn't send any concrete messages. In other words, he's talking metaphorically. Yahweh sent the king of Assyria, but if you ask the king of Assyria, did Yahweh send him? He said, of course not. I'm just going to enhance and build up the kingdom of Assyria. So that notice how Isaiah sees Yahweh working in the inner processes of history and not simply in the sort of working in disguise. The whole business of God incognito is not a new idea when we come to Jesus. So that the whole notion that sometimes God's power is visible, but much of the time God is involved in the processes which are not named God, so that this kind of thinking, I think, is helpful preparation for the modern period where we talk about many aspects of life without using God talk. And we don't need to use God talk. We don't need to talk all the time about God being in places where God is. But simply because we don't consciously label areas of experience with God language doesn't mean that God is not present in those areas of experience, and that those areas of experience are manifestations of power, of his power and his... some of you want to talk about that some more later, I'd be delighted. To take the spoil and seize the plunder, but he does not so intend, and his mind does not so think, but it is in his mind to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. He thinks he's doing it all by himself. For he says, are not my commanders like kings? Is not Calmo like Carchemish? Is not Hamath like Arpad? Is not Samaria like Damascus? Any big country is going to compare their little things with the other people's big things and get a marvelous sense of its own size. As my hand has reached to the kingdoms of the idols, it operates in some other of our thinking too. We have a marvelous method of building ourselves up. You compare the great example of America's generosity with the grossest example of somebody else's stubbornness. Or you compare the ideal Christian, the most enlightened Christian, with the most unenlightened Muslim or Buddhist. And it's beautiful. You know, you compare the best manager with the worst representative of the unions, or you compare the best representative of the unions with the worst manager, or you compare the best Democrat you can think of with the worst Republican, and vice versa. And it works beautifully, you know. It works beautifully, but you haven't been making a comparison at all. You've been comparing good oranges with rotten apples, and that's cheating. That's cheating. Anybody could do that. Anybody can do that. You got to compare a good orange with a good apple, and then it's not quite as clear which one is better. It's amazing. It's amazing the kinds of logic we have. You know, if you compare a good orange with a rotten apple, well, of course the orange is better. No question. But if you conclude from that, oranges are better than apples, you're stupid. And we must do that because we need to do that. You know, because it's perfectly clear that that isn't the case. So that
And at the same time, just that the logical argument is invalid. It's not a case where you're actually saying that oranges are not better than apples. You haven't actually made an argument one way or the other for the whole case of oranges or apples.
No, you really haven't.
We haven't even discussed the question.
You haven't even discussed the question, but you really have gotten yourself a model that enables you to prove something to yourself when you need to prove it. Is not Samaria like Damascus, you know? Is not Calmo like Carchemish? Is not Hamath like Arpad? Is not Samaria like Damascus? As my hand has reached to the kingdoms of the idol, whose graven images were greater than those of Jerusalem and Samaria, shall I not do to Jerusalem and her idols as I have done to Samaria and her images? And then there's a sort of intermittent verse which describes more in prose. When the Lord has finished all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, he will punish the arrogant boasting of the king of Assyria and his haughty pride. I suppose one of the theologian in the modern, I still think that the theologian in the modern period who has reflected most deeply in terms of American experience on these themes is Reinhold Niebuhr. And although his language is difficult now, more difficult now than it used to be, there's still an awareness of the ambiguity and the pretension, the pretentiousness of our images of ourself that we can chew on a good deal. Like that beef stuff, you know, where you chew and chew and chew and you're still getting some energy out of it. For he says, by the strength of my hand I have done it, and by my wisdom, for I have understanding, I have removed the boundaries of peoples and have plundered their treasures like a bull. I have brought down those who sat on thrones. Now this is the emperor of Assyria speaking, you know. I've got the whole world in my hand. My hand has found like a nest the wealth of the people, and as men gather eggs that have been forsaken, so I have gathered all the earth, and there was none that moved a wing or opened a mouth or chirped. Now the prophet responds to the quote from the Assyrian king with rhetorical questions. Shall the axe vaunt itself over him who hews with it, or the saw magnify itself against him who wields it? The axe says, gee whiz, look at all I've done. That's pretty good. As if a rod would wield him who lifts it, or as if a staff would lift him who is not wood. We might have a little trouble with the good solid rhetorical questions. We might have a little trouble with the mechanism, you know. A country is not simply an axe. It has some kinds of autonomy and vitality and intentionality. But the main point of the dependence, the interdependence of human experience, so that any person or any nation or any group of nations which view themselves as somehow out of this fabric of interdependence, out of this fabric, and somehow in charge of the fabric of interdependence, have gotten a curious backward perspective on life. Therefore, the Lord of hosts will send wasting sickness. Two images, the images of plague and fire, and the poets here describe them very vividly. The Lord will send wasting sickness among his stout warriors, and under his glory a burning will be kindled like the burning of fire. The light of Israel will become a fire, and his Holy One a flame, and it will burn and devour his thorns and briars in one day. The prophet was much taken with the image of a fire, which could, which could do a host of damage very quickly, and was something that was sort of accidental, something arbitrary, so that the fire or the disease could destroy the enemy. When Israel didn't have the military might to destroy the enemy, so that they were, the fire and the disease were really symbols of that surprising turn of circumstances that they attributed to Yahweh. The glory of his forest and his fruitful land the Lord will destroy, both soul and body, and it will be as when a sick man wastes away. The remnant of the trees of his forest will be so few that a child can write them down. One of the twins could go out and count the trees left in Holden Valley. And it will be like an old man dying of cancer. Now we get introduced to another aspect of Isaiah's thought, in which what I would call the logic of remnant. In that day, beginning with verse 20, in that day the remnant of Israel and the survivors of the house of Jacob will no more lean upon him that smote them, but will lean upon the Lord, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. A remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. For though your people Israel be as the sand of the sea, only a remnant of them will return. Destruction is decreed, overflowing with righteousness. For the Lord of hosts, will make a full end, as decreed, in the midst of all the earth. How in the world is the Lord's really going to deal with the arrogance of Israel and ultimately the arrogance of Judah? How in the world is God going to be able to continue his work of developing a good human society that will be a light to the nations and be a model to the Gentiles? How is this going to be accomplished? Well, one of the obvious things is that he's going to start all over with a little group that's left. So one of the obvious models is when it's all over and the city's destroyed and the people are in exile, he's going to take just a little colony that's left and start the thing over again. You might call it God's, what's the yeast? Yeah, what's the yeast? The starter yeast, you know. It's God's starter model. So that there is in Isaiah, the remnant theology is basically that there's going to be a little bit of starter saved, a little bit of fire saved from like the Greeks had somebody carrying a little bit of fire on a stick, you know. There's going to be a little bit saved, and God's going to use that to rebuild. So that it gave the faithful in Israel another possibility. It certainly became clear at some points that they would not reorient the direction of the nation. And so that at some points the task shifted to the maintenance of the quality of insight in the remnant. So that during the exile, much of the preoccupation was not with building up the nation, but with collecting the tradition, helping a small group to remain faithful to the old vision. so that there was a strategy for the nation, and when the nation was unreachable, there was a strategy for the remnant that enabled them to set about. Now, and I think you can see this same strategy in operation in some of the monasteries in the Middle Ages, where the monastic communities preserved a quality of Christian life and insight and learning in a society that had become fairly barbarous and had not yet been re-civilized for the first time. Kenneth Clark is all wet about starting civilization in the 8th century. In the 8th century in Europe, there was a brilliant Muslim Western civilization going strong, and he just started in back country, that's all, his pictures. But, you know, that was civilization, but there was a lot of it before that. Okay, so that the remnant carries civilization, and it bursts out again and gets rebuilt. So that, and I think in some senses, this is the strategy, the remnant strategy is the strategy of the, some of the Free Church movements and some of the Anabaptist movements. The society is so far gone, that the only thing that can be done is to pull together the remnant and maintain as qualitative a sense of the presence and the faith and the covenant as is possible. Now the funny thing about in Israel, it was one strategy and then the next strategy. In our experience, you may have the remnant strategy happening on one corner and the still trying to address repentance to the folk happening on the next corner. And I, for one, think that's not too bad, because one of us may be wrong, you know. And then there's a, like the Roman Catholics in Spain, you know, there were some people that were advisors to Franco, and there were some people that were in the workers' movements and this sort of thing. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I think one of the major issues that we have to discuss as people of God is, you know, I happen to be of the opinion that the immigrant generation of our tradition was obsessed with the remnant strategy and felt themselves as disestablished, but then they became established, and about 50 or 100 years later it dawned on them that they could preach to the country and not simply to the Norwegian or Swedish or German ghetto, and that they really, you know, and so that it dawned on the preachers a little bit after their folk were really successful and integrated into society, and that was a bit tardy, so that you've really got to take a good look at. You can't just justify. You see, God's got a lot of strategies. And you can probably find a precedent for all of the strategies of the church in Isaiah. But the point is, have you got the right strategy for the right time? Have you picked the strategy that fits? You know, are you playing remnant when you're still in Judah, and you might just turn around the kings of Judah? The kingdom of Samaria fell in 722. The kingdom of Judah lasted till 585, and you might get another 200 years out of America if you work at it. And you don't have to start being a remnant until there are a few bombs dropped on our country. So, okay, so remnant is a very good strategy, but just don't paranoia yourself into being remnant before you're really a remnant. I mean, you know, you'll know it when you're a remnant. You can tell.
I've seen it too for some years, Vernon, that the kind of a difference between, to draw a caricature, Lutheran theology and social ethics posture and a Calvinist theology and social ethics posture. The Calvinist is always with Calvin in the city of Geneva, building up the city, inventing a new water system, etc., vigorously in the world and working for its redemption. So the Lutheran, conversely, it seems to me, is hiding out all the time with Luther in the Wartburg from his enemies. And I think you put your finger on it a few minutes ago. That kind of paranoia, I think, is very temperamentally suited to Lutherans, that remnant. And it's not so bad, either. There are times when you have to...
Well, I just want you to, you know, I think really that you get a much... I want you to widen the spectrum, because in the... there are... After the... With the Reformation, begins to, in that century, you begin to see four different strategies develop. And the difference between each of these strategies is the way in which they mix continuity and discontinuity. And that hinges on how radically they perceive evil. So theologically, one of the most crucial choices you make is whether you think evil is moderate or radical. How you see the shape, how you read the face of the devil, in part determines the strategy that you select. Because, for example, after the with the Reformation, you had your Anglo-Catholic, you had your Roman Catholic Reformation, which was a response to the Lutheran Reformation. You had your Anglo-Catholic, which was moderately. You had your Lutheran Reformed, and you had your Anabaptists over here. So that you really had a whole spectrum of subtly different strategy. But at least at this point, all we have to do is, and maybe, you know, maybe the Calvinism of preaching to the king, I guess, Isaiah is still preaching to the king and to the folk most of the time, and just in this instance, he's beginning to talk about the remnant. So, remnant model. In that day, the remnant of Israel and the survivors of the house of Jacob will no more lean upon him that smote them, but will lean upon the Lord, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. A remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God, for though your people, only destruction is decreed, and so on. Therefore, thus says, okay, let's see. Don't be afraid of Assyria, in verses 24 to 27b. O my people who dwell in Zion, be not afraid of the Assyrians when they smite with the rod, lift up the staff, for in a very little while my indignation. There is something about power that is, there's something about the way that humans get wrapped up in power that will ultimately bring itself down. Yahweh has built into power its own limits. Okay, this is a curious, I didn't really understand this next oracle until one of my students did a paper on it. And because I never bothered looking up those crazy names, you know. And what's fantastic is those are all the steps, those are all the little towns that the Assyrian army is here hitting. So that every time you move from one town name to the next one, you're hearing about the army's gotten to Eau Claire, and it's gotten to Dubuque, and it's gotten to Albert Lea, and it's gotten to Faribault, it's gotten to Northfield, and you see the army, and it's just a fantastically dramatic thing. But if you don't do your geography homework, like some of us, then you don't get it. So let's just imagine we've got the scheme of these towns. And Nancy can bring the map. Have you got the Hebrew there? What? Maybe you should read it in Hebrew. Huh? One of these days we'll get together on it. He's gone up from Rimmon. He's come up to Aiath. He has passed through Minyan, Miron. At Michmash he stores his baggage. He has to leave his baggage. Then they're going over the pass. They have crossed over the pass. At Geba they lodge for the night. No, this is really like coming over the mountains. They've got as far as Cloudy. Ramah trembles. Gibeah of Saul has fled. Cry aloud, O daughter of Galim. Hearken, O La Isha. Answer, O
her O'Annon thought, Madmana is in flight, the inhabitants of Gabim flee for safety. This very day he will halt at Nob. He will shake his fist at the mountain of the daughter of Zion, the hill of Jerusalem. He'll come up to the edge of the city and shake his fist. And then another one of the oracles, very metaphorical oracles against pride and arrogance. Behold, the Lord of hosts, will lop the boughs with terrifying power. The great height will be hewn down. Just the Lord is like that thunderous wind which comes in and breaks off the top of the tree. And then the rest of the tree will be hewn down, and the lofty will be brought low. He will cut down the thickets of the forest with an axe, and Lebanon with its majestic trees, bigger ones than these, and Lebanon with its majestic trees will fall. So the image of the falling forest, and we've seen quite a lot of those, and burnt forests and forests harvested for lumber are some of the images that Isaiah sort of reflected on, that gave him some sense of this mysterious limiting of activity in life. There is about our experience a breakthrough of limits, not just expansion. And this, to understand, to find some sense of intelligibility in the arbitrariness, and takes some process. Now we get to the Messianic Oracle, and you'll notice that the chapter 9 concentrated heavily on the Messianic King and talked about the situation of the people, talked about the fact that the new David would be born and that the kingdom would be established. So it was an oracle that focused most upon the crisis of succession. One of the major problems in a dynasty is that point of turnover. It was at the point of turnover of power that the northern kingdom always had its big revolutions and had its big troubles. And you can see this in some of the smaller countries. You can see it in our own country with the death of Kennedy, for example, there's a certain sense you wonder if the government will go on. So that the focus of the oracle in 9 is about the son being born, there will be continuity, there will be succession, and the government will be upon his shoulders, and he'll inherit and be crowned with all the titles of the kingdom, and so that you focus more on the beginning of the Messiah model, the Messianic model, with the initiation, really, of the Messianic leader. Now, this says more about the quality of the leadership, more about the activity of the Messianic age, and then there's that marvelous passage at the end in which there is the sort of playful suggestion that a new era, it's hard to know with that final section in 6 through 9 whether this is the prophet's imagination having the creation empathize or dramatize the human situation, or whether, and I tend to think the latter, whether the prophet still, as an ancient man, has a sense of the empathy and the interdependence of man and nature, so that he realizes that if the human society sets itself right, that there will be a new order, there will be a new relationship, there will be a change in the natural circumstances. If human beings perceive and live out of interdependence, this will alter their relationship to the natural order. And so these they're wonderful. We have a lot of Christmas carols about them. You know, there's something underneath them that are worth. Would you note now, as I read it, it's the Messiah comes out of Jesse. This is the Davidic kingdom, the branch. They love the picture of the stump being cut down or the plant being cut down and then the new shoot. What a marvelous picture of hope. When the thing has been cut down and a new branch comes out of the old stump. And that's an interesting picture, you know. Old stump, new branch. Continuity, discontinuity. Something new, but something new that comes out of something old. So it's both old and new.
I find it interesting, set in contrast with the verses just above it, where the forests are hewn down and everything is apparently laid dead, and again the stump, that the stump that this root of Jesse is going to come out of is also apparently dead, and then this new growth comes out.
There is, in fact, I think one of the passages previously where, in fact, the later editors added. One saw that connection and added a little line, the seed, the holy seed is the stump, you know. And the problem is that is true about the dynasty of David, but it may not be true about everything else. And it makes a fantastic contrast, the contrast between the stumps that don't generate and the stump that does is a magnificent one. And then you'll notice that the messianic leader is endowed with real leadership, wisdom, understanding, counsel, knowledge, respect for the Lord, and he'll enjoy God. You know, this isn't a heavy simply a heavy duty relationship to Yahweh, but it's he's really with it, and he's internalized it and made it a happy thing in his life. He's going to be probing in the courts, and the 3b through 5 marks the messianic age by the concern for justice. He doesn't just take superficial evidence. He doesn't just listen to the people, what his advisors say, but he has his integrity deals with the poor. He discriminates for the poor of the earth, the meek of the earth. He curtails evil. Righteousness and faithfulness will be the girdle of his loins. You see that same kind of concern for domestic and international justice in that oracle we skipped way back in Isaiah 2, 1 through 4. And there you have it almost in League of Nations or Supreme Court terms. And come to pass in the latter days, the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established at the highest mountains. Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, that he may teach us his ways, that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the Lord, the law. He shall judge between the nations, decide for many peoples. They shall beat their... Notice, so that the character, just the establishment of a just government, a just messianic leader, and leads to the establishment of world courts. And when there is world court, then they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. So this is a very concrete, pragmatic image.
Israel is to, in a sense, become the, because they have the Torah and a special measure of Torah, they were to turn into a kind of source of learning and discrimination that would provide a kind of world court that would enable an era of justice to prevail, not simply internal to Israel, but between Israel and the nations. So let me just read Isaiah 9:11. There shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots, and the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord, and his delight will be in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes see or decide by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth, and he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall slay the wicked. Righteousness will be his belt, and faithfulness will be his trousers. The wolf shall, now we move into the next one, the wolf will dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf, and the lion, and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall feed their young. Their young shall lie down together. The lion shall eat straw like the ox. The suckling child shall play over the hole of the asp, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the adder's den. They shall not hurt or destroy. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Amen.
Amen to that.